The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Oran McIntyre. Now, this is Oran's second time on Millennial. He was on 2 years ago, and I think most of you will already know of him, but he's an American commentator, content creator on YouTube, on Odyssey, and on Twitter, and I believe on Substack as well, Oran, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. And I think you're one of those people who have really done well over the last couple of years. I think there's a group of people who I think have really sort of blossomed, and you're one of them. So without any further ado, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, thanks. No, I appreciate that. I'm Oran McIntyre. I've got a YouTube channel. That's kind of where I started everything. But now I'm also writing and doing podcasts over with The Blaze. So I've got a weekly column there and a show over there. And then I've also got a book that's going to be coming out soon. Just got all the last drafts and everything turned in with a publisher called The Total State. So a lot's been happening in the last year. It's been quite a ride.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. What would you say about? I think 2022 was dominated by really the Ukraine war. And then at the end of it, well, the end of COVID first, then the Ukraine war, and then Nord Stream towards the end. What would you say 2023? Let's go through some key events of 2023, because nobody has actually done this yet on Millennial this year, apart from White Papers. So give us your own Cook's Tour version of 2023.
Yeah, that's interesting because, so, you know, it seems today that with the churn and everything, you know, the current thing, everything runs together quite quickly. I mean, the Ukraine continued to dominate, and it was very interesting the way that transition occurred, because, like you said, obviously that came so quickly after the fervor of the pandemic. And of course, you know, the going joke was, you know, the Indiana Jones replacing the COVID virus with the Ukrainian flag.
Oh, yes. I remember that meme. Right.
And it was really interesting because, you know, in a lot of ways, you looked at what happened during the pandemic and it felt like kind of the global order or the global American empire, however you kind of want to understand that, had really stretched a lot of its credibility. You know, the managerial apparatus that wanted to globalize and wanted to move beyond the borders of different countries and kind of seal us all into one governable mass, it felt like they had pushed things too far a little bit with the pandemic. There had been an exercise of great power during that time, but there had also been a dangerous excess of kind of seeing how far you could lock down the populace. There had been dangerous interruptions of supply chains and other things that had really messed with the economy. And the way that they had approached that, you would think that there would have been a cooling off period, right? That they would have stepped away from any exercise of power, any great disruption, to just let things cool off a little bit, let the anti-elite fervor die down. And instead, they went directly into everyone has to be involved in Ukraine. And that became kind of the central narrative. And the immediate reaction was, you know, people like Joe Biden, our president, was just like, well, we're basically just going to cut off the economics of Russia. And, you know, the same thing I think America does with every one of these conflicts. It'll be over in 6 months. You know, we'll strangle them and economically, and we'll flex our soft managerial power and that will just shut down Russia's economy. They'll lose access to the banking system, all these things, and that'll just solve our problem. And kind of the opposite happened. Russia ended up being able to leverage a number of countries away from the United States diplomatically and economically. It was the United States at that time that, you know, we've had the energy market kind of level out, but we had the big spikes in costs and things, while Russia ended up having a number of kind of resurgence in things like the value of their currency, and, you know, the United States had a lot more economic troubles. And so it was this weird scenario where you thought that these guys would have calmed down, and instead they just put their foot on the gas, and they said, even though we just spent all of our political capital on locking down our populations and damaging our economies and messing with our supply chains and all of this stuff, we're not going to take a moment to recover. We're not going to let things cool down. We're immediately going to press our luck. And this really, I think, speaks to the invincibility that our elites were kind of feeling. On one hand, they're almost panicked because they constantly need to exercise control or power. The minute anyone pushes back against them, they go through these histrionics about, you know, how it's the rise of fascism and all of these things. But they also constantly feel like they need to be invulnerable. Like any step away from just exercising their will at a moment's notice means that, you know, that they're no longer in power. And it's really interesting to me that they just don't seem to have the ability to regulate themselves, to regulate their ambition. They're constantly worried about their position, but they also can't understand how to operate any other way than pushing things to the limit at every opportunity. And I think that's, to me, what kind of defines 2023.
You see, what I would say is in 2020, because that I would say that's when that was an incredible year, and not in a good way. You had COVID, and then BLM, George Floyd and BLM, and then the presidential election. And by the end of that year, I mean, it really did feel like an odyssey, where everything feels different than, and I think with regard to what you're saying, assuming that was the work of the elite making decisions to foist these traumas upon the public, for want of a better term, well, would you not say that was their peak? Like at the end of 2020, they had screwed the public in America, but all over the West in multiple ways. I mean, the lockdown and all of that, the fear-mongering, the terrorizing of people, separating of grandparents from grandchildren, all the stuff with ivermectin, all of that. And then BLM, George Floyd, statues getting taken down, streets renamed, all of the trauma there. And then the U.S. election. I mean, that would seem to me like the peak of a regime that sees the public as putty to be abused and reshaped, orchestrated, animated, taunted, manipulated. And then I think they were probably on a high after that. And I think that's why everyone was dreading 2021. Like, what the hell are they going to unleash this year? And it started with January the 6th. Not much, comparatively little happened in 2021. But then 22, Ukraine. And then you've got this, as you say, this huge new drive to everyone to support Ukraine and Zelensky, even personal lionizing of him as a brand. What would you say to what I've said just right now?
Yeah, no, I would agree with you that was kind of the fever pitch of them attempting to exercise their power, which is like why I said you would think that, like, after stretching, you know, kind of flexing the way they did and stretching their credibility, you know, testing the limits of their power in the way they did, the manipulation, the level of, you know, the level of involvement they put in kind of all of that, you would think that they would take some time to cool off. But the immediate entrance into the conflict and the push to have this absolute support, you know, suddenly everyone was a traitor if they weren't on board with this. That was very interesting. It was weird to see the left interestingly try to paint the right as not patriotic. That was a moment that they tried, and they still trot this out on NBC when they're kind of preaching to the choir. But it was interesting to watch that.
That's so bizarre, because you'll probably remember the whole thing with Freedom Fries, where it was the Iraq War, or maybe the Afghanistan War, I can't remember now. And that was the right, chastising the left for being cowards and unpatriotic. And it actually is the inversion of that now. It's incredible. To have lived through that is really something. It's just confusing.
Yeah, but to be fair, also in some ways encouraging. You know, it was very nice as somebody who is now in contact with, you know, more of kind of the mainstream conservative sphere. It was very nice. I mean, obviously you still had kind of the Fox News crowd pushing the Ukraine war in a lot of ways. But of course, big voices like Tucker Carlson were against it. And largely, I would say that anything that's not, you know, directly in that kind of neocon influence sphere on the right stepped away from the Ukraine war in a big way. And there was a moment where it felt like the right was picking up some of the anti-war mantle in that way. Now, I think being anti-war is kind of stupid. That's why I'm not a big fan of libertarianism, because they often pick that one up. I think war is a part of human reality, and there are just wars and unjust wars, and sometimes, you know, that's just part of life. But the war skepticism of kind of the military industrial complex and defense contractors lobbying, you know, this became part of right-wing rhetoric in the United States, relatively mainstream right-wing rhetoric. You still have, you know, presidential candidates on the stage like Vivek Ramaswamy. I mean, there's a lot to say about Vivek, but coming out and specifically criticizing, you know, the kind of bloodthirsty nature of neocon candidates like Nikki Haley, that's a big change. That's a sea change in the way that the right sees itself, especially in the United States. And so I think it was very encouraging to watch that, because a lot of people, I think, you know, in kind of the online right, they look at the more mainstream and they're like, well, none of that can ever change. You know, it's all controlled and there's never going to be any shift. And they're right to be skeptical. There's a good history. You know, there's every reason for them to be skeptical. But it was nice to see that what felt like a genuine shift, you could explain to people, this is not a war that benefits you. This is not a war that is for America. It's not for the people here. It's simply a way to spend your tax money. It's simply a way to launder your money to forces that have no interest or are actually, you know, against you. And so it was very nice to see that shift, even if it didn't last forever. It still is encouraging to know that an argument can be made for the interests of the average American conservative that they will listen to, and they say, okay, actually, I'm not going to support this war because I don't see how, you know, running Ukrainians into Russian bullets ad nauseum actually does anything for the United States.
Indeed. I wonder, would you be able to list the reasons why your average American conservative was gung-ho about the Gulf War, gung-ho about Iraq, gung-ho about Afghanistan? And yet something happened, maybe several things happened. And 10 years later, 2016, there were 17, there was the thing about Trump and the Syria missile strike. They wanted to go to war. There was a certain push for that. And basically, the average American conservative just seems to have lost interest in American foreign wars. What do you think's happened? Why has that change occurred?
Yeah, no, it's been remarkable, because I grew up as a military brat. My father was in the Air Force. I remember being worried that he would have to go to the Gulf War. I grew up on American military bases, and I grew up as a talk radio conservative, you know, listening to Rush Limbaugh and people like that. And you know, I was in high school during 9/11. I remember watching the Twin Towers go down and, you know, different teachers talking about turning the Middle East into glass in response to those kind of things. So I vividly remember all of these things, you know, as kind of a part of growing up. And I had a lot of friends who ended up going to Iraq and Afghanistan because I had so many close military friends, and losing people there and things. And so it has been interesting to watch that shift, because, like you said, I feel, you know, when you look at the 90s, America was still very close to the idea of peace through strength. Ronald Reagan, you had ended the Soviet Union. Your greatest, you know, geopolitical competitor had gone away, and you moved from a bipolar world to a unipolar world. It was clear that America was dominant, and you end up with this kind of Francis Fukuyama end of history narrative that very clearly affects both the left and the right. I mean, that's a very neoconservative argument in a lot of ways. And I think that was what a lot of people on the right were holding on to. Okay, you know, they truly believe that in many ways were exactly right, that the Soviet Union was an evil empire, that it had been defeated. And if they're evil, then you must be the good guys. And now you're in control and you'll rule with benevolence. You know, now that there's no one else kind of involved. I think there was a real, you know, optimistic understanding that there could be this age of peace under the Pax Americana that would come from the Soviet Union. I think a lot of conservatives who had rightly opposed communism and everything that the Soviet Union had stood for saw this as the next logical step to kind of what America should be doing with its power. And so I think early on they were gung-ho with going out and still projecting American power because it still felt like the moral thing to do. If this was the power that toppled the Soviet Union and ended the threat of communism, then why shouldn't it naturally spread, you know, and democracy, you know, everywhere, you know, George Bush, there's, you know, the democracy in the heart of every human, as ridiculous as that is.
And using the phrase installing democracy, like a software.
Right.
You know, I remember that seeming amazing at the time.
Right. And that's just, I think, the way that American conservatives understood it, where, you know, there was a genuine understanding that this is the good faith thing you were going to do to help bring freedom and prosperity to the world. If it worked for America, why wouldn't it work for everyone else? And then, you know, you have 9/11, and there's still this, you know, America feels attacked, which it was, of course, and, you know, horrific tragedy, a real terrorist attack, a true, you have to understand how far America had been removed from warfare. You know, World War I and World War II did not happen in America the way it happened in Europe and other countries. So, yeah, we had Pearl Harbor, but that was it. You know, there had not been a real attack on the mainland United States forever. And so this felt like a very real scenario where we could constantly have this. We could constantly be under threat. You know, Americans for the first time had kind of come to grips with their mortality. We were not in an invincible colossus that would never be touched anymore. And so I think it's very understandable that, you know, there's an easy sell of, okay, there's people over there. You know, the model of battling against this kind of thing is you go to a state and you blow up the leaders of the state and you know, take over. And that's how you solve, you know, attacks on your mainland. That made sense at the time, because I don't think we understood the nature of kind of non-state actors in warfare. But, you know, over time, it became clear that there was no plan for what these wars were going to do. And you have to remember who fights America's wars. It's not Democratic supporters. It's not guys from urban areas. It's guys from Appalachia. You know, it's Texan boys. They're the ones that go out. They're their hard chargers. They're the people who are filling those frontline combat ranks. And, you know, they're the ones who are coming home with missing limbs or never coming home at all. And eventually conservatives had to kind of look at what was happening and say, is this worth fighting for? And I think by the time they got to Ukraine, the answer was no. You know, the idea that you were just going to be this global, you know, peacekeeper at the cost of the blood and treasure of, you know, America's heartland. Well, we've been told that America's heartland was evil and racist, and they didn't really want to be involved in this anymore. And I think, you know, that's why you saw the support die down by the time we got to Ukraine.
To what extent do you think the changes in the American army had anything to do with this? You know, the trans generals, the endless stuff about LGBT, the multiracial, the diversity, all of that kind of stuff. Do you think that had much influence here, or is that actually a side issue?
I think it certainly had influence. There's a real danger in putting institutions like that up for grabs ideologically, because when you do that, you really alienate a large section of your population. And like I said, the military's front line had been populated mostly by guys who wore Trump hats, you know, and so it had been happening for a long time. Again, I have a lot of friends in the military, and they had been saying for years, hey, you know, we're getting corporate diversity training. You know, this is not something that cropped up in the last 4 or 5 years. This has been happening for well over a decade in the United States military. You know, they had been trying to, of course, inject diversity into units, be it, you know, female, racially, you know, sexually, any of these things. It had broken up unit cohesion. You have to do all these trainings so that, you know, people, you know all the special new rules. You know, these are people who shoot other people for a living. They don't, you know, they shouldn't mess around. This is the kind of thing that they need to be worried about, but it suddenly became the primary thing that every military unit was worried about. And then, of course, we also saw that while all of this wokeness was shifting in, and you know they were elevating bureaucrats rather than warriors, or the general staff were made up of guys who were more like CEOs or, you know, university professors than, you know, grizzled veterans. And then by the time we got to the pandemic, it was very clear that the regime was more worried about people who weren't loyal to it under arms than it was about the combat effectiveness of the units. And so they used the vaccination requirements as a way to purge Trump supporters out of the military. And so by the time you got to the actual Ukrainian conflict, many of the most effective warfighters in the United States military had been forced out for political reasons. Those that remain kind of knew the game at this point and were trying their best to dodge it, but they knew that their units weren't going to be as effective. And the support that would have been traditionally behind the conservative community, well, all of their friends and family were being thrown out of the military because they didn't want to take the jab. And so, yeah, I think it definitely has a huge impact on the support of conservatives, on the effectiveness of the U.S. And obviously the U.S. didn't technically have any units directly involved, but it really puts the regime on pause when it comes to how effective they could be if they had to be deployed.
Yeah. And of course, this is the kind of thing that ideologues don't see coming. But it's only when it actually has an effect, you realize, oh, I've alienated so many people. Because, of course, it's quite opposed to the type of person you actually need in a military force. It's not a touchy-feely, someone who's aware of people's needs and their preferred pronoun. I mean, it's completely different, a totally different mindset from being an efficient killing machine, basically.
Yeah, and the regime has done this on every level, right? So there's Machiavelli, you know, talked about lions and foxes and how these are kind of the two main ruling types, the two main forces that move ruling bodies. And the lions are the clever, you know, they're the tricksters, they're good with languages, they're good with solving logic problems, they're good with you know, building complex bureaucracies, these kind of things. And then you have the lions, and they're what you think, you know, they're the bold, the patriotic, the strong, they're the grunts, they're the people who are going to get things done. And he said, you know, a healthy regime understands they need a mix of these things. They're constantly having a circulation of elites so they can bring in new blood from each one of these kind of personality types, because, you know, you need the lions to go out and forage the land. You need the lions to go out and protect the land. You need the lions to, you know, to grow your food and deliver it and, you know, fix your trucks and make these things run. And then you need your foxes to solve complex social problems, figure out your banking, figure out your, you know, your things like this. It takes both kinds, right? But if your civilization gets sick because it's becoming ideologically rigid, if there's only one type that's allowed to dominate, then eventually it ends up pushing out the other side you really need. And it's very clear that the West in general, and America in particular, is now selecting exclusively for foxes, right? They only want people who are ideologically aligned with the quick and the clever and the people who work in numbers and information economies and these things. And they think that they've moved beyond the need for any of those knuckle dragging apes that would have done things like deliver their food to their, you know, to the grocery stores or fight their wars. And so that's why you see the military, it's even though it's an organization specifically designed to be lions, to go out and do the job of lions and do what lions do, they're pushing the Lions out because the Lions are ideologically going to be more conservative just by nature, and they're so intolerant of that. They think that they're so advanced that they can leave that part behind. We'll just fight everything with drones or something, and we'll never need some guy from Tennessee to walk in and kick in a door and actually clear a room. So it turns out that's not how the world works. You know, your food doesn't come from grocery stores, and your wars aren't fought by drones. You need actual people who do these jobs, and they have a particular style, and that style is not progressive.
Yeah, I think they were probably hoping to build an army that's something like what you would see in Star Trek, you know, Starfleet, where they're liberals, but they know how to get the job done. And they can be ruthless and very resourceful and crafty, but they're liberals. They're efficient and highly disciplined, but they're liberals. And I remember Vosh, and this is something that really made an impression on me at the time, maybe unjustly, maybe it was just a trivial comment that he made, didn't mean much, but it really struck me. He was doing one of his live streams. Do you know who Vosh is? Just
yeah, I'm familiar. I've only caught like one of his debates, but
yeah, of course. I'm not that familiar with him either. I just know him as this miasma that everyone's aware of and people talk about now and then. And I just can't stand him. You know, I find him loathsome. And anyway, I was watching this stream of his, and he said that he was talking to a hypothetical secessionist. Somebody who wants some conservative, some right winger who doesn't like the way the America's going and is going to break, or he wants his state to break off. And Vosh said, fine, do it. We'll only invade you anyway and take you over.
And well, yeah.
That, I thought that's amazing. So you're talking about, you're a liberal or progressive imperialist who will not bear the existence of someone who a state that doesn't agree with you. So you've got not just installing democracy, but installing progressivism by force. That's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Well, that was always the case. That's the beauty of liberalism. It is a globalizing force. It has to be. This was predicted by pretty much every critic of liberalism, from Joseph de Maistre to Thomas Carlyle to Carl Schmitt, that this would be the nature of the regime, that you know, the globalizing force and homogenizing force would need to be imperial. And you know, we had a lot of the justifications for imperialism, specifically of the American variety, left over from kind of the Cold War. I think, understandably, again, when you have a power like the Soviet Union, and you see the way that communism spread in that time, and you're terrified of it, then I think you kind of understand that, well, if we don't go and stop this, or if we don't defend this country, then the Soviets will just take it over. You know, we can look back and we can say that's ridiculous in hindsight, but I think it's a very real concern at that time, and we have to put ourselves in the place of people who are watching their, you know, the countries being devoured by this force that was, you know, filled to the brim with world-ending weapons. But that narrative has died out. You know, that narrative is gone. In fact, the left organized itself against that narrative at first, and now that they're the ones in the driver's seat, they need a new narrative for the imperialism. And the narrative has become exactly the things you're talking about. It has become progressivism. Yeah, I used to joke about, gender regime change. But you know, that is literally now the excuse we give. One of the first things that, you know, the left does whenever it declares its next war is talk about the importance of injecting equality for women and LGBT rights and things into whatever country they're about to blow up. And so, you know, that meme, that joke about like Raytheon with the rainbow flag painted on the head of its bombs.
Botsnex in Botswana.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a sorry, whatever, sub-Saharan African country that just banned homosexuality. Looks like you're going to need some freedom. And that is literally what's happening now. It's not even a joke anymore. It is just the world we live in. And, you know, the United States raises a pride flag over every country it puts an embassy in for a reason, over the Holy See, you know, because this is now the casus belli for any conflict that the progressives want to begin.
Yeah, and I can understand what you're saying with regard to milquetoast liberalism, that it needs to expand, it wants to expand. Of course, any ideology doesn't like the idea of competitors. I can understand all that. But it's when it gets to the point of being progressivism, like SJWs, trans, gay, women, and so on. And then you've got Vosch saying, we will, this army of transgenders, gays, etc., will take you over. That's when it seems like an incredible contradiction, because that milieu of people have been facilitated by the, you know, the caring attitude of the state back home, the open-mindedness, and so on. And but now they're going to be a destructive fighting force. Now, obviously, it's all hypothetical. And as you said, it might well be that they'll just use drones. And maybe that was what Vosch was thinking, that, well, we don't even need the lions anymore. We don't need the knuckle-dragging apes, the optimates. We can just use technology, because this is how advanced we are. So some gay guy, some, you know, trans lesbian or whatever, can just push the button to do the to make the thing do the thing, and it will do the thing. And hey presto, you can take over a secessionist state.
I mean, it really is the way that they understand combat. It's amazing, because, you know, I read Machiavelli's discourses on Livy last year, and it's amazing. He's talking back then about artillery, which is a relatively new invention in warfare at the time. And basically, people are just explaining to him how, you know, artillery is just going to end the need for any kind of infantry. Infantry's done. You'll never need infantry again. This is the, you know, 1500s, 1600s. You know, infantry's done. You'll never need infantry again, because this technology has just made it, you know, obsolete. And that has been the way that many people have thought about warfare going forward. They've been trying to phase the infantryman out for, you know, 500-600 years, always thinking that the next piece of technology is going to make the lion obsolete, and the foxes can just rule without the need for any of these people. But it turns out that that just never quite happens. The technology never comes. And so, yeah, these people who have never been in a fight in their life, and they don't know anybody in the military, and they don't understand anything about this, you know, yeah, they believe that you can fight a war this way. And even the people in the military believe that you can fight a war this way. If you could just, you know, spend, you know, billions of dollars on weapons projects, eventually you can phase out the need for the grunts. But it never quite works out. And, you know, they end up losing a war to goat herders. And,
yeah, well, indeed. And that was the big confusion about Afghanistan. How did that go wrong? How did America end up withdrawing from that country with its tail between its legs? I mean, it is still a bizarre thing. I still don't understand it. I mean, some people say, well, America could have won that war. They just lost interest in it. It became more trouble than it was worth. Or they'd done the job. But I don't think that's true, because now the Taliban are in charge again. So clearly it's not the way it was supposed to be.
You have to think about what win that war even means. Right? What does it mean to win a war in Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires? You know, are you gonna what, turn them into a Western liberal democracy? I mean, come on. This is the main problem, of course, right? Is the idea that every people is interchangeable, that every country can be governed the same way, that you can convert everyone to the same system of government and just impose the same norms on a nation that, or, you know, that isn't really even a nation and never has been. That was never going to happen, but that was the mode of victory that people understood, and that was never going to happen.
Yeah, and that was always a problem with Afghanistan. I remember people saying that years and years ago. What are the victory conditions? What is the exit strategy? What are we actually there to accomplish? And I guess after a while, that they just ran out of energy, being unable to answer that question. So to get back to this year, what would you say were the, I mean, obviously, okay, so Ukraine, you, as we said, it dominated last year. How would you say that has evolved this year? Because it seems to me that a year ago when we did Last Millennial, it was still very much the case that the mainstream view was Russia cannot win this. Ukraine is just a matter of time before Zelensky is triumphant, and Western values prove themselves once again. And since then, fairly recently, I'd say maybe halfway through this year, and then much more so recently, that view has completely fallen away. And there are even people very close to Zelensky who have said, I think it was in Time magazine, they gave interviews to a journalist, and they said basically Zelensky is obsessive and delusional, and there's not really any way that we can win this war. So Russia's victory is inevitable. They've got platoons with the average ages 40, 45, this sort of thing's going on. So how has that played out in America?
Yeah, it's very strange because, of course, like you said, from the very beginning, it was really important to never pretend, you know, Ukraine was always going to win. There was no, you know, it was delusional to believe anything else. In fact, it wasn't delusional. It was treason. You know, and if you had any other understanding, there was no way to have a value neutral assessment of military conflict. That wasn't an option. You know, that any hint that there were real logistical and military concerns with Ukraine's ability to long term win a victory against a major power, you know, was just meant you were an agent of the Kremlin. You know, and that's what the left and unfortunately, parts of the right have been doing for an extremely long time in the United States. Of course, you know, Russiagate was central to the hamstringing of President Trump and his administration. And, you know, that was something that utterly proved false, but was successful in its propaganda designs. And so that's all it really needed to do. It survived long enough to do that. And of course, that primed the pump for a media that wanted to feed into this narrative when it came to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And I'm no military expert, but a lot of people I trust had said from the very beginning that the idea that Ukraine was going to win this war was insane. And yeah, you can, you know, just plow hundreds of billions of dollars into Ukraine, and we certainly did. And, you know, but again, it's a problem of technology, right? The idea was that if you could just buy the Ukrainians enough, you know, missiles or tanks or drones or small arms or whatever, that eventually just through, you know, the sheer number of crates of American taxpayer money you threw at them, they would eventually win the conflict. But that wasn't really the problem. You know, that was a problem for Ukraine, of course. The problem is, you know, Russia, despite its, you know, more dilapidated state since, of course, the heights of its power as the Soviet Union, is still a major geopolitical force. It still has a real military. It still has a long history of well-trained troops and fighters and military leaders and things. And there was just never going to be this case where Ukraine was actually going to be able to grind this out. And it became, I think, pretty clear here, especially even though it took an insane amount of propaganda overcoming in the West, you know, in America, that it was almost impossible. A lot of people were getting all their news from Telegram. And I'm one of those people who, you know, if I can't tell one way or another, I'm not going to sit here and speculate. So I didn't know who was going to win. I wasn't sitting around speculating who was going to win, because the information we were getting from both our own government and from, you know, people who were pro-Russia was so spun that there's just no way to know what was actually happening in the region, unless you were actually there. And obviously that's not a place you wanted to be. And so it was hard to know what was actually happening, but it's becoming pretty clear at this point that, you know, the support for the Ukrainian war is waning. It seems like the easy victory that was supposed to be achieved, that the Biden administration was selling to Americans, is not going to happen. And even though Mitch McConnell gleefully, you know, with like blood dripping from his mouth, talked about how it was important to, you know, fund Ukrainians, because if we could just get enough of them to die, Russia would eventually like just fall over for us. But even as they attempted to do that, it feels like that fervor is dying off. And of course, the attacks on Israel and the ensuing conflict between Israel and Palestine and Palestinians has pretty much come to now dominate the current thing, which means, you know, they're still trying to write $100 billion checks to Ukraine. They're still trying to sneak those bills through Congress. And unfortunately, I think that probably will be successful. But the public's attention is gone. And really, that is the deciding force, as sad as it is in geopolitics these days. And so I think that without that kind of fervor, now that that's been directed somewhere else, I don't think that they're going to continue to just float Ukraine infinitely, but you know, there's a lot of money still be made there, so maybe they'll try.
And then, well, moving on from that, what other events happened this year that you think were important in the long run?
Well, in the United States, obviously, the huge story has to be, Donald Trump and the way that he has been persecuted by the United States government. He's a former president of the United States. He is the most prominent political opponent of the sitting president. And the security apparatus of the United States has very clearly been turned against him. I mean, they raided his home, pretending like he had, nuclear security codes or something that he was planning to sell on eBay or something. They ended up indicting him on pretty much every level imaginable, from, state to federal charges. They fabricated insane charges for him. And of course, this extends well beyond Donald Trump himself. They've prosecuted his administration. The people who were working for him have faced incredible amounts of persecution. They have brought charges, of course, against January 6th protesters, many of which who didn't even enter the Capitol building are now facing insane charges, which only stands in more stark relief to the political bias when you look at the fact that, Antifa members that burned down, fast food places and actually laid literal siege to government buildings in the United States during the riots of 2020 are getting off with, community service or a month or two of house arrest. When you look at the political prosecution of the political opposition in the United States, it's very clear that we've crossed a very serious line in our country, where you're directly not just going after this man's supporters and his staff. That's crazy enough. That's already a violation of pretty much everything that's supposed to be in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, which they're using as toilet paper at this point, no matter how much conservatives scream about it. And now they've just actually directly gone after their political opposition. And so we have this clown show happening on the right in the United States, where we have these GOP primaries where guys like Ron DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley are talking about what they're going to do as president, when literally the guy who's ahead of them by 30 points in any poll is under indictment by the federal government because they want to keep him from being able to run against them. They're terrified of having Trump come back. Some people say that's not justified. They're probably right about that. But that is the way they're treating him. And the fact that we've crossed that line in the United States is pretty amazing.
Do you think that Trump realizes what he's up against this time? Because he clearly, I don't think he realized what he was up against the first time in 2015, 16. Because I think if he had realized, then he would have behaved differently immediately after winning. I think he would have put, what's it called, the transition stage. I think he would have put together more loyalists and fewer establishment Republicans into his administration, and not set himself up for failure in the way that he did, in my opinion. Do you think basically that Trump is a different man from the one we saw campaigning in 2015-16?
No, unfortunately. So in some ways, yes. The thing is, in 2016, I don't think Trump expected them. I really don't. I think the most shocked person about Trump's victory was Donald Trump. He had no clue how to govern. Like you said, he had no real idea about the transition team, building a cabinet, understanding what it took to really govern the United States once he got into office. And when he got there, it was very clear that, he was frustrated by the inability of his loyalists to take action. You have to remember that early on, he was surrounded more by people who were loyal, part of the campaign, those kind of things. But eventually, Steve Bannon's got thrown out and John Bolton's got put in because they were the experts. They were the effective actors. And it became very clear that Donald Trump had installed a bunch of people who actually were just trying to put him in the corner, who really despised him and his voting base, and really saw the populist American movement as a danger to the conservative establishment that was used to running when Republicans were in power. You know, you you had the crazy progressive side of power, and then you had the incredibly moderate, you know, right-wing side of power. But that was never supposed to challenge anything that the left had done. At best, it moderated some of those things so they could be accepted by the populace. So those changes could be locked in. But the idea that you would actually come into office and fight the things or roll back even the things that the left had been doing was just, that was not something that was going to be done. And so I think in many ways, you know, Trump lost his presidency because he had no clue what he was doing when he got in there. He had no clue who to put in power. And once he did transition to people who were quote unquote capable, they ended up being people who were dead set against him. And you can see that. I mean, half of his administration at this point has written books about how they subverted him. You know, his generals write books about how they ignored his orders. You know, his secretaries and national security advisors and things write books about how they fed him false information and lied to him and these things. And it turns out none of these people are up for treason, which is amazing. But, you know, that's what happens, I guess, when you're out of power.
I would say Trump is sort of exemplifies this weakness in the right, because he's so full of bravado and ego, and he says the right thing and he talks a good game and all that. But then when it comes to it, and he does that far more than any other right-wing politician has over the last few decades, and that's why he was so popular. And yet, when it actually comes to it, he, as you say, he doesn't really have any vision at all. I think the same is true of Boris Johnson, actually, in a different way. He doesn't have any vision, and he certainly, and this is the key thing, and it's amazing for a businessman that he wouldn't know this, he doesn't have any notion that you have to destroy your opposition.
Yeah. So there's a lot of people who invested in the idea that Ron DeSantis was the more effective version of Trump. And you can kind of see why, how they get there, right? They see Ron DeSantis, you know, take on Disney, and they see him pass laws that are controversial and actually punish his enemies and reward his friends. And they say, well, that's a guy who can manage things, right? This is, you know, sure, Trump had the bravado and he could come in and he was the bull in the china shop that broke open kind of the control. But now we need a guy who can go in here and kind of get things done, right? And can manage a bureaucracy and whip things into shape and execute policy. And they're right. They're right to an extent that is who Ron DeSantis is, and that's not who Donald Trump is. All of that is true. But I think there's something important to understand about the actual movement that was kind of around Donald Trump. Donald Trump is in many ways, you know, I mean, he's a reality TV star. He's I don't know the man personally, but feels like what you see is what you get at this point. And so it wasn't ever really about Trump. I mean, it's a Trumpian movement in the sense that he was elevated as the leader of it. But really what Trump was speaking to was the last gasp of American identity. There are a lot of conservatives who knew, a lot of people in red states who knew that their country was being taken from them, that they were, it was being hollowed out and being sold, and that, you know, they're bringing in another set of people who are going to vote the right way, and really that their backs were up against the wall, and they had just never had anybody who would articulate that. And while Trump
But if he did articulate it, then why didn't he believe it? Or did he believe it?
That's the beauty of Trump. Trump is a salesman. He's a TV actor. He's a hollow shell, right? The reason Trump worked is he said things that he wasn't supposed to say because he didn't know he wasn't allowed to say them. Trump is not a politician. And so when he heard the customer base, when he heard Republican voters, actual conservatives, actual red staters, say what they wanted, he said things back to them, like, I'm going to build a wall. I'm going to put in a Muslim ban. Like, he said things that were just outrageous that no one was allowed to say. And no one had said for a very long time. People who had watched their jobs sold overseas for decades, often to countries their fathers had died in wars against, were tired of it. They never believed in this globalized economy. And Trump was the first guy on the right to say, actually, no, I'm going to fight for, you know, tariffs, and I'm going to return manufacturing to the United States, and I'm going to protect you. Just things that were unfeasible to kind of the neoconservative right were now things that Trump would say, not because some of them he believed. I think in his heart, Trump probably actually believes in the economic success of America. But a lot of this stuff, like, I don't think Trump was pro-life. I don't think he's an evangelical Christian. But, you know, he became one because that's what the base wanted to hear. And so I think he said a lot of things that no one was allowed to say, but he didn't know then what to do to make them happen. And that's where he ended up being in really serious problem.
So then I guess the question is it just the same thing now? I mean, the thing is, obviously, a lot of stuff has happened to him, both when he was when he was campaigning, then when he was the president for 4 years, it was constant obstructions, as we said. And now, even more so, since he's out of office. Well, first, he got banned from Twitter. Let's not forget that. I think that's significant in itself, because Twitter is now a different story, obviously. But that alone, that event, being banned from it, should have made him see, bloody hell, I should have taken action against Silicon Valley, social media, big tech. And so that's one thing. And then since then, obviously, all these lawsuits. So do you think he's a bit wiser now? I mean, this is what I'm trying to get to, because by the time of next millennial, the election will have happened. All of this will be a done deal. So basically, do you think he stands more of a chance of being an effective president? Let's assume that he gets in next year, despite all the lawsuits and whatever. Let's assume he gets in. Do you think he would be any better than he was 2016 to 2020?
I think he will be better because he'd have to be. I don't think there's another option for him. Like you said, there's so it's less about what Trump is and more about what Trump can be memed into. I think a lot of times when we look at these events, I don't know if you're a video game guy, but we like to look at these guys as if they have like roles and stats, right? Like they're going to be deployed in, you know, and DeSantis is 10% more effective in policy, but Trump is 15% more effective in persuasion or whatever. And so, will he slot in effectively into the scenario? I think that's a wrong way to understand things. I don't think it's, I think what's the better way to understand things is the world historical forces that are going to be acting in that moment. So I think that I don't think Trump is the guy who's going to like punish all of his enemies inherently. I don't think Trump is the guy that's going to crush the opposition inherently. I don't think Trump is actually even a lion. I think Trump is a fox who plays a good lion. I don't think he has kind of the constitution that a lot of the people on the left want to attribute to him, that because that's the kind of villain they want, right? They're establishing the return of Mustache Man. And so, they want Trump. They want to meme Trump as this guy. But that's not Trump. Who Trump is, I don't think. I don't think that he has any of that in him. However, Julius Caesar didn't become Julius Caesar until there was no other option, right? Like, it's not until basically it becomes illegal for him to stop conquering Gaul that he has to, invest himself in the possibility that he's gonna end up, crossing a Rubicon. And so the left is in this weird position where they've decided that the best thing they can do, because the left in America have painted themselves into quite the corner. They have pushed the envelope in pretty much every way. They've leveled political persecution on people in every way. And they're terrified of turning the government back over to their political opposition because they're worried that the thing they built would be turned on them, that they would be treated the way that they're treating people like Trump right now. And so, I think that to some extent, Trump would have to just be wiser because of some of those realities. But in other ways, I think Trump is just who he is. And I don't know how seriously he can take any of that stuff. But what will be far more interesting is not so much what Trump does once he gets into office. What will be far more interesting will be the way the left loses its mind, because it will. It's going to, you think they're unhinged. You think you've seen the edge of the abyss when it comes to progressive insanity. We're not even close. We haven't even begun to glimpse the way that these people are going to go insane. And they already more or less instigated a nationwide riot to keep Trump from getting elected last time. What do you think they'll do this time.
I wonder if we would get to a reenactment of that famous, remember the guy shouting no
when the the screaming on their knees up to the heavens.
Yeah. It'd be great to get a sequel to that, but
you'll certainly get that for sure.
Well, it's I agree with you with what you're saying about Trump. I think he is basically a bit, you know, shallow, a bit dumb. You know, I'm sure he's smart at what he does in business and whatever, but in terms of world affairs, politics, philosophy, God knows, he just actually does seem like a bit of a dumbass, which is a strange thing to see. But the other thing is that the way you paint him as a salesman, this is exactly what the left always said about him. And they've said the same about Nigel Farage as well in Britain, that he doesn't actually mean anything that he's saying to you right-wingers. And you right-wingers are fools for believing him and falling for his trick. He doesn't care about you, and he's not going to help you. The left have said that about Farage. They've certainly said it about Trump. And they were correct, which is rather depressing.
Well, I'll say this. I believe Donald Trump loves him. I think that that's the difference. He isn't particularly ideological. And for a lot of people, that's a downside. And I understand why. But I think that's an upside. I think that one of the problems for politics across the board has been the obsession with ideology instead of an interest in caring for particular peoples. And I think that's what Trump changed. That's what he broke so many of the Republican kind of walls that they weren't allowed to touch. You know, why would people whose sons go to fight for war be in favor of infinite war, forever war? Doesn't make any sense, right? That the people who are watching their sons come back wounded or killed from this should not be in favor of constantly injecting themselves into every foreign conflict. But they were, because ideologically that's what they were told, you know, went along with their other beliefs. There's this artificial packaging of foreign policy and other and economic interests stapled on to the conservative American identity. And that ideological baggage had kind of pushed things to the breaking point, but it was becoming clear that these things were deleterious to Americans. And so Trump, as somebody who loves Americans, is talking to these people who fight these wars, is like, why do we want to keep fighting these wars? Do you want to keep sending your kids here? Is this how you want to spend your time? Is this how you want to spend your money? No. Okay, right? Same thing with the economic plan. Why would people who work in factories, who live in the heartland that is being hollowed out by globalism, why would they be economic free traders in the sense of, you know, not caring about how that destroyed their community? Trump said, well, no, I care about those things, and you should care about your home, and so I'm going to change the economic policy of the party. And so all of a sudden, these things that had been just untouchable, you know, these kind of libertarian attachments to the conservative agenda that had just been a bedrock since my entire life, the whole time I've been politically aware, were suddenly just swept away in the course of a couple of years. That's amazing. That's a sea change. And you can say whatever you want about Donald Trump, and you'll be right mostly. But the fact that he cared more about America than he cared about ideology broke the Republican Party in the best possible way. And I think he should receive credit for that, if nothing else.
Yeah, and I remember him saying that he was a nationalist. And I think he meant it in a particular way, obviously. But that what he meant was that his primary concern was America. My point is that I don't think he is able to follow through on that. Because when it came to it, he couldn't take on these forces.
Yeah, you're 100% right about that. And again, I don't disagree with any of those shortcomings. I think they're all right. They're all correct, and they'll probably show themselves again. But you know, I am a political realist. When it comes to analysis, and so when I'm doing political analysis, I don't reach for like what I want to happen or what I think would be ideal or who I think would be even best for certain things, unless you have the opportunity to change it. What I'm looking at is what's going to happen. And the thing that's going to happen is that that the conservative base kind of imbued Trump with their hopes and dreams. And he is desperately unworthy of that, but he's got it. So that's what's going to happen. And they saw him basically have his first presidency stolen from him by the deep state and from, you know, a conspiracy to create these Russian collusion narratives and things to kind of hamstring his ability to do anything. And then they watched his ability to get reelected get scuttled by all the events of 2020. And they look at him as somebody who's an incumbent, somebody who still has their loyalty, and they don't think anyone else should be involved. And so he's going to be the nominee, for better or for worse. And so the only question, again, is I think the far more interesting thing than what Trump is going to do, though that'll matter quite a bit, of course, is going to be the way that the left reacts to him. Because I think that Trump being in power again is going to create an unhinged thing that we've never seen before. And whether he'll be effective or not in the midst of all that, probably not. But I do know people who were involved in the Trump administration who are changing that. I had Andrew Kloster on my channel. He was a guy who's involved in the hiring and the staffing of the Trump administration. They're very aware of the failures that they had there. They brought up they created the Schedule F plan to hollow out the administrative state if they were to take power again. We've got guys like Vivek Ramaswamy talking about the importance of destroying the administrative state, hollowing out and discarding the managerial regime. It's not. Are they going to be able to get all that done? I don't know. It's a gargantuan task. It's something that's going to require, one of the great political victories of all time. Is that in them? I doubt it. But it's at least they know the problem at this point. That's much better than the right has seen for a very long time. So I try to be optimistic when the option presents itself. And those are steps in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. I certainly agree. And I'm not trying to dampen anything here. I hope, and my hope is that Trump, actually, regardless of his own intrinsic beliefs or lack thereof or his intentions or whatever, what I hope is he gets in and the people around him are better than they were in 2016, 17, or rather that they are more aware. If it's the same people, then I hope that they are more aware and more ruthless, much more ruthless than they were back then. In which case, his own beliefs are kind of irrelevant. We'd be much more likely to get the action that is so direly needed in America than we were in 2017. Why do you think that the left would go crazy? Because you've said this twice, two or three times now. Why do you think that they would go so apoplectic about a second Trump victory more than they did the first time around? I'm curious about that.
Because the left is full of true believers. We look at them and their control of everything, and we say, how could they possibly believe that, the right or Trump is going to come in and, just sweep the table and suddenly, install The Handmaid's Tale or whatever delusional kind of fantasy they have of an evil white right-wing regime. Like, how can they believe that when they look at, the fact that they can get anyone, in the world, fired, just by blinking at them, when they can shut down people's bank accounts, when they can exercise all of this power? How can they possibly believe that any of these people are a threat to them? And the answer is that they believe their own propaganda. That at some point, there were smarter people in charge of the left who understood the difference between the narrative they were selling to the base or to the rest of the country and what the elites should actually believe and understand. But that time has come and gone. The left, we like to think that they're all cynical actors, and they are in some ways. Like, they are on board because of power. They're there because this is the way the benefits flow and this is where the Gibbs come from. But they also have really kind of digested a lot of this. And you have to understand how artificial the life of the average leftist is. I mean, think about what it takes to maintain trans lifestyle or these kind of things, right? Like, this is stuff that is requires a massive government bureaucracy, a massive state that inverts the natural hierarchy to such an incredible degree that really any disruption of that constant feed of power and control to the left would actually collapse it. And I think this is ultimately what they're worried about. They've so radically altered the natural structure of human existence that they realize how delicate it is. You know, they've built this massive edifice, but it's an upside down pyramid that could be blown over at any moment. And so they realize that, you know, that they've assembled this massive Leviathan, this total state, as I like to call it, that is required for their artificial way of life. But if anyone else gained control of that, or if any part of that was disrupted, it could all come apart in a moment. And so they kind of have to build, in order to justify the amount of power they've centralized, they have to turn Trump into this massive threat. But they also rightly understand that, like, if any part of reality reasserts itself, this whole thing could come crumbling down. The structure they've built is just incredibly fragile. I mean, think about all of the competency they're hollowing out of critical places like the military and, aviation. Doctors, you know, are being selected on their, you know, how many sexual partners of random genders they have and their skin color, rather than whether they can actually do their job. You can't hold the complex society up like that forever. But more importantly, you can't hold it up if, you know, someone comes in and says, no, we're going to get rid of this artificial thing. And I think Trump represents this to them. They're very worried that he will come in and do the things that they are doing to their enemies to them. I don't think he has it in them, but they're definitely projecting that onto him, and they need him to be that kind of villain for that. And so whether Trump is that person or isn't that person, they need him to be. And so they've made him that way in their mind. And so when he takes over, they're expecting that, whether it's real or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they do talk about him as a fascist dictator and a tyrant and an authoritarian. And this is completely against the evidence, but they seem to believe it. And often I wonder, do they really believe, is this a facade, a role they're playing for some reason? But I think most likely, they're certainly ordinary leftists, just on the ground, as it were, they really do believe it. It's quite incredible, actually. So here's another question. I asked you this once on Twitter, and I'm curious what you would say now and verbally. Trump getting in would obstruct, if nothing else, it would obstruct the left's plans to at least some extent. So my question to you is, how far do the left want to go? How far do their plans extend? What is their ultimate vision for society?
Well, I think a lot of it is they've told us. You know, the funny thing about leftism is it's not, or progressivism, is they have not been particularly coy about this. You know, if you look back to the 1960s, a lot of people feel, you know, certain ways, I guess, about Chris Rufo. But if you go back and read Chris Rufo's book about his current book about the Cultural Revolution, he documents very specifically, the way that the left was talking about how they wanted to transform America, how, you know, the Marxists and the racialists at that time wanted to transform things. And they were not unclear about their design, about, you know, wanting to topple what they saw as a white Christian patriarchy and replace it with their own power and their own belief systems. But I think that the left, you know, you look at the foundations of things like queer theory, and they were very clear about what their, you know, goal was, which was abolition of the family, abolition of, you know, the restrictions on all sexual activity, including between adults and children. Like, this is not stuff that's hidden. You know, like, they've gone back and tried to clean some of this up now, but the documentation is very clear. You know, Foucault wasn't really, you know, on the down low with his preferences and these kind of things. And so I think this agenda is not new. I don't think it's particularly stealthy. I think it's been here for a very long time. I think it's the natural outgrowth of the idea that you need to replace everything that came before. They understand that I think the order that existed previously was one that restricted their desires and the way that they wanted to remake the world, and that all of it needed to be dismantled, and that include, you know, families, religions, peoples, national borders. All of these things had to go because all of them are a restriction on kind of this, you know, global homogenized unity. I think that the ideological proclivities of the left have grafted themselves well onto kind of the desires of managerial capital. And so the things that had once been necessary to the leftist project when it came to economics have been more or less sheared away. The kind of the Gramscian revolution of kind of race and sex has been the one that's been successful inside the United States, as opposed to the economic one that had originally been posited by people like Marx. But the goal is still the same. You know, the abolition of family was just as much a goal of Engels as it is for the modern feminist or for the modern gender activist. And so I think that that's, again, nothing has changed. The tools, the avenue has changed a little bit. You know, they've realigned themselves with capital because they found out that was a much more effective vector for their plan, and their plan was far more the domination of those things, I think, than was actually the dismantling of capitalism or whatever. But otherwise, the plan has been more or less the same. They want the gray goo. You know, they want to destroy all distinctions between peoples so that everyone can be managed exactly the same way under a global order. I don't know that means there's like large cabals of people who have declared the global order outside of the ones that, you know, we see at the, you know, Bilderberg meetings or something. But I do think that is ultimately, the goal, even though they may not articulate those things specifically. You know, you're going to own nothing, you're going to be happy. Those things that they have articulated specifically. And I think that's where they're going.
Yeah, I think that what they're up for, what they want, their vision is nothingness. But ideally nothingness plus comfort, plus luxury. So another way you could say it is this luxury space communism.
Yeah, no, 100%.
So, okay, one last question then. And that is about the what I would say is the biggest event of this year, the biggest story of this year, and that is the Gaza conflict with Israel and Palestine. How do you think that has changed things? I mean, we don't need to go into the mechanics of the conflict itself, but I'm more interested in how has it changed things geopolitically, and especially in America?
Well, it's had a number of very interesting downstream effects. So the first thing has been, of course, obviously the focus off of Ukraine. That's the biggest thing. The fact that it shifted kind of the desire of war funding and possible avenues and just kind of the constant news cycle grind definitely shifted to that conflict. And it seems in many ways, you know, I'm going to keep referencing memes without any visual content. So, you know, I'm that boomer, but just, the child discarding the Woody doll from Toy Story, I'm done with you now, you know, and that was Ukraine and Zelensky. And then they picked up the Israel conflict. But the most interesting dynamic that has come from that, outside of obviously the loss of focus on the Ukraine war, has been the split inside the left, because the institutional left, of course, was, I think, pretty pro-Israel, had a history of supporting them. But it's very clear that the woke left, kind of the insurgent left, the radical vanguard, is not. They're much more kind of a third world faction. They're more interested in ideas of decolonization and equity through the third world. And many of the leaders there are from places like Palestine or are adjacent to countries that have grudges against Israel. And so there's a shift in the dynamic there where something that would have been probably a hegemonic support for Israel, a decade or two ago, now has created a really dynamic split inside the American left. And you have a lot of the people who feel beholden to the state of Israel continuing to defend it and making noises about pulling funding from universities or things that are protesting it. But there's a real threat against that institutional power from kind of the woke vanguard, who see themselves as ascendant. And when it comes to a leftist purity spiral, you want to be on the outside. You want to be on the woke vanguard. That they've won pretty much all of those battles. This is a big bet between me and my buddy academic agent as to whether or not the kind of more establishment left will be able to put the woke away, or whether or not the wokeness is going to overtake the establishment. And my firm belief is that the true believers will win this one. The ideological outside edge is going to overtake. And I think we're seeing that now as this conflict develops.
Well, that debate about putting the woke away is premised on the idea that the woke, the left will decide that the woke should be put away. Mm-hmm. And I guess there wasn't really much reason for them to do that, to make that decision, until the Gaza conflict. And then suddenly wokery becomes a huge problem for them.
Well,
Go on.
I mean, there were reasons to put it away prior. Like we talked about previously, the competency crisis is a huge issue. Like, they can keep replacing ideological or they can keep replacing competent people with ideological.
Sure. But that's a long, slow burning. I mean, it's the kind of thing that they can easily delude themselves about. I take the point. But I think the Gaza conflict has really brought this into sharp focus, that the left has become. There's a huge contingent of the left that is in stark opposition to the desires of the establishment left.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right that the competency crisis is there, but it is a slow burn, and this is something that snaps things into focus, and it brings those fault lines into sharp relief, kind of inside even the woke movement, because of course part of the value that wokeness and kind of the leftist identity politics movement, one of the things that it served is it did allow, even though obviously it was a movement that in many ways demonized the idea of whites and Christians and men, it allowed, I guess, the good whites to cancel their enemies, right? Like that was something that they get to do. So like, white women or people who align themselves with the regime could still wield that ideology and use it to cancel their kind of inter-elite opponents. That was a utility of kind of wokeness and why it was allowed to continue. But we recently just saw kind of this split, where both Harvard and UPenn had kind of these movements on their campuses. Both of the university presidents were facing criticism from their donor class because they weren't squashing these anti-Israel protests and things. The head of UPenn had to step down. The president there had to step down. Liz McGill, I believe is her last name. But the president of Harvard is standing behind her. Now, she's a black woman who is now being accused of large amounts of plagiarism. Chris Rufo has uncovered large amounts of plagiarism. But because she's still tied into this DEI framework, it feels like Harvard is compelled to stand behind her in the way that UPenn was not required to stand behind kind of the white female that was running that institution. And so that creates an even further exacerbation, because it felt like a lot of kind of the establishment liberals could continue to ride on the back of wokeness as long as they could be one of the good ones. But when this push comes to shove along these dividing lines, it looks like actually there is a oppression hierarchy, particularly around race, that is holding fast, even in these kind of leftist war pieces of internecine warfare. And that's a really fascinating development, because that brings up the question, like, are these people going to feel scared that they no longer have the ability to kind of shunt the wokeness to the side or aim it at their enemies, and that they can be canceled or they can be removed, while the people who actually have those woke credentials, actually have the correct skin color or sexuality or whatever, they're able to be protected? Like, is that going to be a huge problem for the institutional left? It remains to be seen, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, I remember about a month ago when this was all peaking, I did a meme on Twitter using that bit from Superman, the film, the Christopher Reeves film. I think it's Superman 2, when Zod tries using his powers, but they've gone away, they've vanished, and he suddenly finds himself powerless and vulnerable, extremely vulnerable. And it's a similar thing here, where Zionists in this case will try using certain arguments, but it doesn't work because they're too white, and that makes them vulnerable, because of course they've built up this whole thing about white privilege, white supremacy, and so on, and so suddenly it all backfires. I mean, it's very, very ironic.
all of a sudden the decolonization narrative doesn't just apply to, you know, Americans or, you know, Frenchmen or Englishmen or whatever. It applies to you too. Yeah, that's something that leftist Jews have put themselves in quite a bind over. Because again, it's a dangerous place to be in a purity spiral. The woke vanguard has won most of these battles, and a lot of people thought, you know, that this is just never going to be the case. But evidence seems to be to the contrary. You know, the Palestinian protesters are, I think, on the whole, winning many of these battles, and the fact that the left has decided to bring a large amount of people from that region in, or people who are sympathetic to perhaps the Palestinian cause, into the United States and use them to populate their movement, means that there's a lot of people who don't feel an innate guilt or a need to kind of stand behind the nation of Israel in the way that the left has done previously. And that puts them, yeah, again, in just a very difficult ideological showdown, because of course they don't want to be canceled inside their own movement. But they no longer have the ability to kind of wield power the same way, because the people who are on the edge, who are on the ideological vanguard, and therefore have the moral high ground due to the decolonization narrative and the Marxist narrative that's been built up inside the movement, they don't care about the state of Israel. In fact, they're quite opposed to it. And so they don't really have an ideological leg to stand on when it comes to the inter-leftist warfare.
Yeah. And what's interesting, well, there are many interesting things about this, but one of them is that these newcomers, which are Palestinians, among many other types, these newcomers to America are so populous in the elite universities that they can wield the authority there. They can wield the power. And I guess there are also anti-Zionist Jewish academics at these universities too, but they don't seem to be, they seem to be a sort of non-player in all of this. It seems to be very much non-Jewish academics and also non-white. And this is my point, really. What we have here is now a conflict between Muslim academics, black academics, and so on one side, and Jews on the other. And nowhere in this is the traditional WASP America. And that's, I mean, it's sad, actually, because it implies that there isn't anyone to fight for you know, traditional white America, and they don't have much of a prevalence in their own elite university, or what are supposedly their own elite universities anymore, because of decades of affirmative action.
Well, one interesting, again, downstream effect of this has, I think, actually been the ability of many people. Again, I'll bring Chris Rufo up, because he's one of the you know, the most active guys in the United States, one of the most effective right wing political activists in the United States, and, you know, along with addressing the narratives of decolonization that have been pointed at Jewish people on these campuses. That has now been stretched also to white Americans, you know, Americans of European descent, and others. And so, you know, an issue that was probably not on the minds of many, even though it was, you know, they might have said, you know, campus culture's gone crazy, whatever, you know, the normal refrain is from the right. They hadn't really focused a lot on the fact that, you know, many of these academic disciplines had become decolonized, you know, or they were looking to decolonize things. And the implication there was always that they were going to bring some kind of hostility to, you know, Americans of European descent. And now that that has stretched into also a narrative about, you know, Jewish people, then yes, that has become more of a concern. Some people say, well, that should have been a concern already. There's a very good case for that, but take your W's where you can get them, right? The fact that that has now become something that people are aware of, that these are dangerous narratives in college, and that they have been, you know, advanced to many different groups before they were advanced to now, you know, Israel. It's good that that awareness exists and that that pushback is occurring. And so I think there's more of a awareness about kind of the way that this has been happening and the courage that's necessary to fight back against this kind of behavior across the board. You wish it would have existed when it was targeting, you know, a group that makes up a large amount of the conservative voter base. That would have been great if the Republican Party had cared about it back then. But it's nice that they're caring about it now. And, you know, you hope that that means that there could be serious victories in that direction. I think, again, the fact that there are many people who are now seeing that you can expose the way that the left has been treating people on campus is critical. I think that the ability to put pressure on the donors, to put pressure on the alumni to see changes occur, I think that's critical. And I'm glad that it's finally happening.
Yeah, certainly. And similar stuff has happened in Britain and Germany and I'm sure all over Western Europe, where there's suddenly this alarm that non-white immigrants aren't on board with the Zionists. Well, are actually openly anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist, but also anti-Semitic. And this is a problem. It's a problem serious enough that we should even talk about mass deportations. But, of course, when these people were being viciously anti-white and often physically, sexually anti-white, that wasn't a problem. And, of course, I don't want to fall into imagine if it were the other way around kind of thing, but it is galling that is the case, that it was perfectly fine for them to be endlessly racist against white people. It's only a problem when suddenly Jews are victimized. But obviously that is the case for various reasons. I guess an interesting question to end on would be, I know you don't like speculating, but could you speculate on how all of this is going to shake out? I mean, is this going to be the way things are now because of the sheer numbers of these people in our societies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a huge question, actually more for Europe than America. You guys have had we've had a large influx for a long time, but we're a much larger country so the percentage of population we have far more, say, Hispanic immigrants than we would, say, Muslim immigrants, even, or, you know, immigrants from Muslim countries. Even though that number is growing greatly in the United States, the percentage-wise, I think, is increasing far more drastically in places in Europe. And so the impact on those countries is going to be far greater, and that will, of course, impact the political dynamic in a far more stark way. I think we're seeing the concentration in places like the university because of the dynamic you were talking about, where they're often, you know, being elevated inside of the university due to different, diversity requirements or affirmative action maneuvers. But I think it's going to have a far bigger impact on Europe. I think in a lot of ways, this is going to be something we're going to be dealing with for a long time. And that's kind of the consequences of open borders. You know, a lot of people thought that economically it would benefit them, or thought that, you know, by just diluting the makeup of countries, that would remove racial tensions because there is no longer be, majority groups, and that would mean that there would somehow be a smoothing of relations. We're obviously seeing the exact opposite, which anybody who looked at history for any amount of time could have told you. But, you know, we decided that we had moved beyond all those things. We're far smarter and more civilized and more progressive than all those people. And so, once you touch the magic soil, you'll adopt all the values and everything will be fine. We're quickly discovering that's not the case. However, we've kind of put ourselves in situations where those, you know, we've taken the easy options off the table. Now, like you said, that does mean that more people are talking about things like the possibility of deportation, which, again, you know, wish we could have done that back when it was a lot easier. Wish we could have, you know, we hadn't gotten to this point, but it's at least good that those things are being opened up. Those discussions are happening because, yeah, at some point, you know, tipping points occur and it becomes incredibly difficult for, you know, people to kind of govern their own countries. And so the fact that, that understanding is entertained in many of these countries that have been transformed over the last couple decades by mass migration, that's a step in the right direction, but for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, indeed. I was just looking for a quote that the quote about the melting pot that is often brought up by Israel Zangwill. It's interesting because what a lot of people don't seem to know about this, and I didn't know until recently, is that he popularized the term in his play, but his own attitude to this was actually that it's a bad idea because it basically diversity brings conflict. And what he used by the term melting pot was specifically about American society at that time. Or at least that's how it looks. And what he was saying was any more extreme diversity than that would be nothing, would yield nothing but trouble. And I mean, I don't know if he was anti-diversity or not, but that's from the quotes that I've seen, that's how it looks. You know, it doesn't really matter. The point is that we've certainly seen this bear out. You know, that's the way it has happened. It has not worked out. Diversity has just been division and conflict and trouble and strife. Okay. Sorry, I wish I could find the quote so that I could back this up, because otherwise it's a bit out of nowhere. But it linked to what you were saying about diversity. Sorry. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I've drawn people's attention to it so that they can seek it out themselves. All right, so we'll move on to... Then. Thank you for this talk. It's been very interesting, and I've certainly enjoyed it. We'll move on to Super Chats. And here's one from Black Pigeon Pilled. Do you see the recent failures in American foreign policy and international de-dollarization as the emergence of a multipolar world? Or do you subscribe to Neil Ferguson's commentary of a new Cold War?
I think we're already in a multipolar world. I think we're already moving that direction. You know, again, that speaks to the foolishness of our elites who rushed directly into a conflict that would bring about or increase the likelihood of multipolar outcomes. You know, they've made it clear that living under the current global order is no guarantee of safety or security or prosperity, and that they might just come after you at any moment anyway. And even when they've stressed themselves to their limits, they'll still kind of do this. And so, I think that we are probably heading toward a multipolar world. And the way that people learn to react to that is going to be huge, because we haven't known anything else for a long time. It's hard for particularly Americans to imagine another kind of world, but it's coming. And so we've got to figure it out.
All right. I certainly agree. And I do think that we're already basically there. And that has been the case I think it's been visible for really since America withdrew from Afghanistan. That seemed like a turning point, a watershed moment, but you never know. Have you collected any Moog synths? No, I haven't. Sorry, E. Keith Woods asks, what does Oren think the Democrat Party and the donor class, or why does Oren think the Democrat Party and the donor class are so supportive of Israel, even as it bleeds Biden's support among his base?
Well, I would say that they're less supportive than they were. Again, I think the vanguard is pulling them away from it in large numbers. And so, it's going to be fascinating to see the way that ends up shaking out, because obviously, traditionally, that establishment has supported the state of Israel, but it's become very unfashionable, even among, as you pointed out, many Jewish scholars to kind of be against that state. And those are the people that tend to lead the donor class ideologically. It tends to kind of move downhill. The culture is defined in these kind of academic settings and cultural settings, and then it moves down into the desires of the donor class. And so, yeah, there's going to be, I think, institutional support. I think there's going to be kind of inertia for a while, but I think you will see it bleed away. And I like I said, I'm really fascinated to see how that shakes out, if that ends up fracturing in some way the left as we know it, because if it does, that's a massive deal. If you know, kind of that support for the state of Israel has to be held on to, or whether the entire left will go along with kind of the woke desire to kind of push the ideological anti-colonial narrative in favor of a traditional support for that state. I'm not sure. I think a lot of people have their, you know, the where they're placing their bets, but I think it's up for grabs at the moment. And the fact that that's even possible, something is a lot of people I don't think would have expected just a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that if we're going to talk about the left and the right, between the two of them, I would say that support for Israel is more common on the right, especially with the neocon types, both in America and in Britain. We've got these dreadful types like Daniel Hannan and Douglas Murray over here who are just zealous about Israel. And I don't want to use the term Islamophobic, but they are. They're rabid about other groups and rabid in their support for it. It's amazing. So I think the right is a more stable supporter of Israel and Zionism than the left is. On the left, it's a strange thing, isn't it, that it does actually make sense, that because The Guardian has a reputation for being anti-Zionist. I think that's actually why Melanie Phillips left The Guardian back in the late 80s. You probably don't know about her. She's the Jewish writer in Britain. And the BBC also has a reputation. And again, it's like everyone thinks that the BBC is against them. Everyone complains about the BBC. But nonetheless, even the BBC has this reputation for being sceptical of Israeli claims of this and that, especially during this recent conflict. The left simply does not like, is not amenable to the idea of homeland, and especially ethnic homeland, especially when it's associated with power. They're fine with the idea of ethnic identity, but only when it's associated with powerlessness. And then it's something to be celebrated and loved and admired because it's so weak and vulnerable. But as soon as power comes into it, as soon as a state is powerful, then the left sort of turns against it. And you see this exemplified in someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who just always has to support the underdog, no matter who it is.
Yeah, that decolonizational ideological drive has overcome any traditional support, and it's overcome traditional bonds or traditional loyalties, and has become the driving force. And so a lot of people, again, coming from third world countries that are not amenable to Israel or its cause, who are Muslim and identify themselves with the Palestinian cause for war, they're the ones who are driving the ideology at the moment. They're the ones that feel like they have the righteous cause, and I think they're only going to gain more power as time goes on.
Yeah, I think you're probably right for various reasons. It is for not just the demographics, that the demographics are going to just drown out opposition to that. And wokery is what is most useful to all these incoming groups. But also just because it's the natural end point of that ideology. As I said, it can't brook a state like Israel existing. And I'm not saying that, all I'm saying is that the left is going to be ideologically opposed to that, for the same reasons that they're ideologically opposed to Britain being, traditional Britain and so forth. All right. Nothing says thank you, Oren, for coming on. Thank you. And Stephen says, any chance of having Ayatollah on this year, Woz? Keep up the good work. Thank you. I didn't invite him on this year, but I'll probably invite him on next year. Says, what's your take on the current debate over trading immigration restrictions for Ukraine dollars? Love your vids, by the way, and Merry Christmas, everybody. What's your take on the current debate over trading immigration restrictions for Ukraine dollars?
Yeah, the U.S. Congress is trying to do that right now. So there's the package deal where basically, the right is tired of funding, the right base, I should say, is tired of funding Ukraine. But of course, the politicians want to continue to do it, and they need to find a way to kind of justify that. And so their new plan is to kind of to tie it to border security funding. The Biden administration has been making noise about increasing border security. I think the likely scenario is that they trick Republicans into, funding Ukraine and Israel, and then they just, end up not enforcing the border anyway, even though the funding exists. They just funnel it into something else. They don't actually close down the border. Now, it could be there's the outside chance the Biden administration understands the damage and the instability that they've created with their open border policies. And they realize that even though they, you know, they still support those ideologically, that they may need to kind of tamp things down for a while, let things cool off, especially as we approach an election season. But I don't even think they're capable of that. I think this is basically just Charlie Brown trying to kick the football. They put the border security in the package. They say, yeah, just all you have to do is sign away, you know, 5-6 times the amount of funding for Ukraine. And then when it comes time to actually do anything about the border, they take the money, but they don't actually enforce it.
Right. Okay. Darby says, insightful conversation, Woz. Also, best of luck to Oren in his great cigar rumble with AA.
Yes, sure.
Okay. And Darby also says, question for Oren. With the populist right seemingly being allowed to win elections again, with recent elections in Italy and Argentina and the Netherlands, could the regime sacrifice a Trudeau or a Zelensky in order to maintain legitimacy leading up to the US elections next year?
That's a great question, and that comes down to the debate between myself and an academic agent. I would say no. I think that that would be the smart move. I think that AA would say this is what the regime should do, and if they were disciplined and if they were wise, they would be willing to sacrifice certain pieces, but I think they've lost the ability to play chess entirely. I don't think they know what it is to sacrifice a piece at this point. You know, they're children thrashing around. They're not, you know, mad geniuses. I mean, the good news, guys, is our opponents are getting stupider. So you know, they've lost their ability to you know, kind of play the grand game the way they used to. But the bad news is that, you know, that means that there's no one intelligent at the helm. You know, sometimes we prefer an evil genius as long as there's someone competent in charge. But I just don't think that's the case. So could they do that? Maybe, yeah. But will they do that? I seriously doubt it.
All right. Okay, well, this has been a great stream, Oren. So thank you very much. I don't think there are any other super chats, so we'll just close it off there. So, all right, Oren, is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
No, man. I appreciate you having me. It's been a great conversation.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed, I think this has been one of the best ones so far, as one might predict. So I'm very grateful for you appearing. All right, I'll be back in about 10 or 15 minutes with the final one for tonight, which is Praise of Folly. In the meantime, Oren McIntyre, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thanks again, man.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. All aboard! Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.